Again, our topic for this quarter is what should we be teaching our children? So, as you can imagine, what shouldn't we be teaching our children? So, there's just a ton of stuff out there. We by no means can cover everything, of course, but I have plenty of material to draw from. Some lessons I may finish, some I may continue on and so forth. I may do two lessons in certain ones with certain of our studies. Some of our lessons will focus on core topics, some on broad topics, some may be more specific that are relevant topics of today's age, what things we must be teaching our children. Maybe things that we may not have been taught when we were growing up, because in some ways the world has changed. But in a lot of ways, the world has not changed. And I want to bring that point across, hopefully. Yes, there's things that our kids are exposed to faster, things they're exposed to earlier than we were, things we never had to deal with, such as easier access to sinful things, internet, things like that. Mass acceptance of certain sinful things that were at one time universally frowned upon, that when we were kids, that we never thought would be accepted. They have to deal with those things. So in some ways, things have changed. But in some ways, they haven't. A lot of ways. One general thought that we hear a lot that we can impress on our kids is this. How often do you hear or have you said things are worse now than they've ever been? I've heard that many times. You may have said it yourself. But is that really true? Let's consider a couple of things. Turn to Exodus chapter 1. And these are just some thoughts. Is it really worse now than it ever has been? As an example, Exodus 1 verses 15 and 16. I'm told here, then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Sifra and the other Puah, when you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. Matthew chapter 2. Of course, that was back during Moses' time. We lived about 1500 B.C., 3,500 years ago or so. And there you saw children actually born and murdered. Chapter 2 of Matthew. In verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. So again here, children up to 2 years old, sent by government officials, policemen in our time or military, to kill these babies openly. Now, aside from maybe China, do we see this in our time today, in our country? We don't see that here. Yes, we have abortions. Abortions are wrong. But to actually go in, a two-year-old child, the police, the military, to go in and kill that child, where their brothers and sisters can see those things, we don't have to deal with that here. And it's such a bad thing, not that abortion's not, but even the world sees that as bad, don't they? So we don't see that here, but it was done thousands of years ago. So is the world worse today? Not in that respect. Anytime, by the way, comments, let me know. Leviticus chapter 18. So again, the teenagers and so forth back living back then would have to see those things. And knowing that their government was doing that. Verse 21, beginning Leviticus 18. Verse 21. You shall not give any of your children to offer them to Molech and to so profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Verse 22. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It's an abomination. And you shall not lie with any animal and so make yourself unclean with it. Neither shall any woman give herself to an animal to lie with it. It's a perversion. Do we see sacrificing of children to false gods? Burning children and killing them. Do we see that today? They did back then. Homosexuality and even bestiality, as we read about here, has been on this earth for a long time. It's nothing new. It's always been here. Why else were they warned not to do it? The difference now is that our kids, the time they live in, they see an excusing or an even celebration of such things. That's the difference they deal with. But it was done openly back then. It's not a new thing, in other words. Did God's people, I mean the Israelites, did they openly at one time worship other gods? They would profess to be God's people. They openly professed other gods, worshiped other gods. They sacrificed, they prayed to other gods. God's people. How have you ever seen a professed Christian do this? I've never seen openly do those things. Now, their lives may dictate they are serving another god. But I'm talking about openly praying to, actually naming or worshiping another god other than Jehovah. I've not seen it. If they profess to be a Christian. Again, not that their lives don't dictate those things. So, is the world worse today? Different? Yeah. But not necessarily worse than those things. Questions or comments about those so far? What's not changed? There is a God. I've sinned against Him. He loves me. He wants me to be with Him forever. He's provided a way that that can happen. That way's through Jesus. And I must face Him one day. That's not changed. And with that, we're going to have our first study for tonight. Our kids live in a world where not everybody believes in God. And are sometimes questioned or will be questioned about His existence. And so tonight we're going to look at some evidences for God, but also evidences of His Word. So things we can teach them, a good base for them to have. That's the first thing we should definitely teach them. There is a God. And if they're questioned about it, here's a few things that can give us proof of those things. We'll start in Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, if someone will turn there. To try to get through this, I may have you all read some verses for me. But the first thing is the wonders of the creation declare the existence, the power, and the glory of our Creator. Someone would read Romans chapter 1 and verse 20.
For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse.
So we can look around, we can see the creation, we can look at our own bodies, our eyeballs, it's often given as an example, and see that there must be a Creator, something had to do this. This didn't just happen. So just the things we see. The wonders of the Bible also give evidence of its author, who is God. The objective of the Bible, if you think about it, is twofold. It's to, number one, reveal our Creator to us, and it's also to show His will. That's the whole purpose of that. Show He exists, reveals Himself to us, and what His will is for us to do. The Bible is not a textbook of science. It's not a history book. It's not a book of philosophy. But when it has certain aspects that speak to those things, it's always true. It's never false. So we're going to examine a few passages here, look at them, that give evidence for the existence of God and also for the Bible as His revelation. So twofold. So first of all, proof of the existence of God. So we'll go ahead and turn to Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4. The Scriptures teach regarding a cause and effect. I mentioned it just a minute ago. In other words, if there's a design, there must be a designer. If there's a building, it must have a builder. If a thing is made, it must have a maker. If there's a creation, it must have what? A creator. Someone please read Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4.
For every house is built by someone, but the builder of all things is God.
Turn over to Psalms with me, chapter 19. If someone can go ahead and turn to Psalms 139, verse 14. Be ready for that. 139, verse 14. And I'll read Psalms 9, chapter 19. First three verses of Psalms 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims His handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard." Psalms 139, please.
"I will praise You, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are Your works, and that my soul knows very well."
Someone please turn to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And somebody else get James chapter 3 and verse 9. We're going to learn here that man is a moral creature. Again, we're talking about the proof of this existence of this God. that man is a moral creature, and man has within himself a likeness to God. We're made in his likeness. Genesis 1 and verse 26, please.
And God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.
So we were made with a purpose. We're made in God's likeness, not after any other one. James chapter 3, verse 9.
Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God.
Made after the similitude to God. This similitude to God that's mentioned there is what distinguishes us from all other animals. We have this similar thing. We're made in his image, in his likeness. It makes us different from all the other animals and those things. Again, with this, of us being a moral creature, even the worst criminals demand a fair trial. Would you agree with that? Even the worst criminals, no matter what it is, they deserve a fair trial. Why? Why do you think that? Man's a moral creature. We have within ourselves, we see that fairness. Where did that come from? Is that taught to you or just something that... They deserve a fair trial. No other outside false information needs to be put this guy on trial. He needs to have a fair trial. We're a moral creature. We can feel that. That's just fair. We can be taught those things, but we just feel those things. That's fair. It's a fair thing to do. Where does that come from, if not from outside us, from God? Man is a worshiping creature as well. Again, proof of the existence of God. There's a universal tendency in man to regard someone greater than himself. All through time and history, what has man always done? Constant. They usually worship something. Where does that come from? Yes, it can be taught, but where does that feeling come from? Now, a lot of people nowadays will shun that feeling, but it's still an inward tendency that's happened throughout all time. In all ages, all cultures, man has been found to be a worshipful being. Again, ask the question, why? Where does that come from? Besides this inward nature that points to a higher being. It's there. Also, proof of existence of God is he's revealed himself to us. He's revealed himself through natural revelation by the things which he has made. Acts chapter 14. Again, the hope here is just some things that demonstrations to teach our kids when they may question themselves. Who knows? Gives them answers, especially when they get older and someone questions them. Acts chapter 14, beginning at verse 15. Told here, men, while you're doing these things, we also are men of like nature with you and bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own ways, yet he did not himself without witness. For he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Turn over to chapter 17 of Acts. Begin at verse 24 through 29. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place, that they should seek God and perhaps feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, we are indeed his offspring. Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of man.
That goes very long, well, along with the reading from Acts 14. We're told repeatedly he's a living God,
right,
not of gold or stone. What's the value of that?
Exactly. And again, they still turn to this inanimate stone.
You can't interact with that.
Exactly.
What hope do you have displayed in that?
Being with that said, where does that feeling of worshiping something come from? On top of that, you know, even if it's something as useless as a piece of stone.
They can't deny. They look around themselves and they see. They can't deny that there's a divine work, and but they don't want to accept that. They don't want to give God the credit for that. They don't want to recognize God. They just want to make their own thing that will give them the freedom to be able to do what they want to do.
I was going to ask the question why, and you just answered it, because they want to do what they want to do. If you acknowledge that there's something else out there, larger than us, higher than us, then you've got somebody to answer to other than me.
They can't explain it away, so they just substitute.
Or they ignore it. You know, the word ignorance, think about it. Ignorance means you don't know, but it can also mean that you ignore. You just don't pay attention to it. Look what I do.
Greg, when you think of it, it always tells me in Acts 2, when Peter preached, it talked about hearts were pricked, that we have been made in God's image, we have a conscience, that those laws shouldn't bother us, things we do wrong. To remedy that, you try to eliminate that which convicts us. And that's God's word that we can have. If it's not there, you remove God from all aspects of life, and that conscience or that which pricks is no longer there.
And they also try to dismiss the truth that's there. You can't fight the truth that's there, so you dismiss the author sometimes, which they think dismisses everything.
If that was ever taught to your kids, as far as their conscience violated of what's right and what's wrong, they would never know. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we answer with, that's just the way it is. And that's the answer, by the way, sometimes. But we need to answer a little more specific sometimes and get details and so they can understand for themselves.
You know, what we have instilled in us reminds me, we had a meeting some years ago, and I don't even remember the speaker, but it was talking about man's moral he was born with, or just naturally God instilled in him. Mm-hmm. He used the example of murder and stealing. You know, that shocks our conscience, and we know that's wrong. We don't have to be taught that. We know to kill something or to hurt something.
Why do you know that's wrong?
Yeah, we know that's wrong because, you know, it violates our conscience, and even stealing something. But God gives us His word also to guide us.
But think, if there really was no God, why would that be wrong? Would it be wrong? My opinion is as good as yours.
It's not a problem. It wouldn't be a lot. It's no problem.
So there has to be some kind of standard that said it's wrong.
I think that's what's so sober about thinking about hell. We can't comprehend any kind of existence or place where God doesn't have a presence. What is a place like going to be like if there's no presence of God or threat of God?
Mm-hmm.
How horrible a place like that would be.
And good comments like that, more things we need to teach our kids, our children. So, I appreciate it. Any more comments? Again, talking about God revealing Himself to us. Again, proof of that. He's also revealed Himself through, we talked about the natural revelation, those things we see. But He's also revealed Himself through special revelation. That's the Bible. What does the Bible provide? What kind of evidence does it provide? You don't have to turn there, but it gives us a ready explanation of for the existence of the universe. What does Genesis 1:1 say? In the beginning. So it gives us an example or a reason for that, an explanation for where this universe came, where everything came from. So the Bible explains that. Now, just because the Bible says it, does it make it, is that proof? To believe the Bible it is. But to the one who doesn't believe, is that proof? This book says that he did it, so. Genesis 1, verse 31. Someone turn there, please. This Bible we have also provides us the knowledge of how such an amazing design is to be found in nature. Go ahead and read when you get there for me. Yes, chapter 1.
God saw everything that He had made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day.
The point here is, again, God created these things. He saw these things. He played heard. He always says after every creation, he says what? It was good. And here he says what? Very good. Adds the word very there to that. But God being the creator of those things. Information that the Bible provides us to show why man is superior to and above all other things. Drop down to, or turn over to chapter 1 and verse 26. And God said, again, where we come from, let us make man in our image. That's why we're greater than the other parts of creation. We're the only thing made in God's image. After our likeness, and let him have dominion over the fish in the sea, over the birds of heavens, over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Verse 27, so God created man in his image, or his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, multiply. We also, the Bible shows us, turn to Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12 through 14 when you get there. Again, we talked about this morality, but it gives us a basis for morality, a right and a wrong. Hebrews 5, 12 through 14 when you get there, please.
Solid food belongs to those who are of full age, that is, those who, by reason of use, have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil.
Again, the last portion of that, we're able to discern good and evil. Who says what good is? Who says what evil is? What you think is good, I may not agree with you. Surely the world does not agree with us. Someone get Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7. Someone please get Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Verses 13 and 14. And then someone get Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27. The first part, again, we're talking about this proof of the existence of God, is we get the answers to some of life's most important questions from the Bible. The first one is, where did I come from? Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7. How many people ask, where did I come from? Well, there's your answer right there. It's simple. We believe in God. Next question we often ask of life's most important questions is, why am I here? Ecclesiastes chapter 12.
You said 13 and 14.
Verses 13 and 14, yes.
Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil.
Okay. So that is why we're here. What's our duty? What's our job? What's the one thing we're supposed to be doing here? And lastly, where am I going?
And as it is appointed for men to die once, but after this the judgment.
Then John chapter 5, verse 28, 29 says, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out, those who have done good to the resurrection of life and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. So again, proof of the existence of God. We're reading from a book that a lot of people don't believe in, and so it means nothing to them. If you believe in God, this is some proof here. What about proof that the Bible is actually the Word of God? How many people question this book being the Word of this God that you keep talking about? Often people have said that you can't prove the Bible by the Bible. You ever heard that? You can't prove the Bible by the Bible. Well, let's see. If someone made the claim, if you watched the news tonight and someone said that they had found an additional work of Shakespeare, we all know who Shakespeare is, and they discovered an additional work that had never been known before, how would they prove it? Well, those who know the works of Shakespeare very well would compare it to what? Other works of Shakespeare, if they're similar and so forth. And they can make the determination based simply on that, whether it be the writing style, the words used, what it may be. That it's truly a book by Shakespeare. They closely examine those works, compare. In the same way, when we examine the Bible, we can see its author is God. So let's look at a few evidences and see if that's possible. We mentioned that the Bible is not a science book. It's not a history book. It contains some scientific things. It contains history. It's not a book of philosophy, although it has things of philosophy in it. But the first one is, do the contents of the Bible harmonize with the facts of science when it's there? If the books of the Bible were written by mere men, and they were written by men, correct? They were inspired, but they were men. If they were written by mere men, then they would contain some of the things commonly believed in the time they were written. If you lived in 1970 and you're writing about something, you would make references to things that were relevant to 1970, would you not? If you wrote a book today, 2016, you probably wouldn't use things that were used back in 1970 scientifically. You'd use the new data that you have in 2016. Example, when the Bible was written, over a period of so many thousands of years, 1,500 years, it was universally believed that the earth was flat. Now, you've heard that. Okay. Now, I looked into that a little bit. Magellan circled the earth and proved. That back then, they didn't have what? They didn't have satellites back then, did they? Moses had a satellite he could look at and see the earth. They only had the earth they were standing on. They didn't have airplanes, even that. So, how did they know these things? So at some point in time, unless someone else told them, they had to think the world was flat. Again, Magellan sailed around the earth and he proved that. But before that, Aristotle, 300 B.C., so 300 years before Christ, Aristotle in his writings actually proposed that the world was round. I didn't know that. And I'm taking some man's word for that, by the way. But that was 300 years before. Now, he couldn't prove it, like Magellan did, by going around. But he proposed that by looking at the stars and the arc of the earth and so forth. He proposed that this may be a round world. Now, that's 300 B.C., before Christ. Was some parts of the Bible, a lot of the Bible, written before 300 B.C.? Yes. So if he proposed that. Moses lived about 1,500 B.C., not 300. That's 1,200 years. How old is, think of how old you are. Think back 100 years ago. Now imagine 1,200 years ago. It's a long time. Big difference. Aristotle, 300 B.C., supposedly proposed that. Moses lived that back then. Isaiah, which we're about to read from in just a minute, was about 700 B.C. So about 400 years before Aristotle proposed this, something was written in here. Proverbs was written anywhere between the numbers I saw, 1,000 B.C. to 600 B.C. when they were compiled. But still yet, hundreds of years before Aristotle had done this. Someone turned to Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 22. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 27. And again, at some point in time, when the Bible was written, common belief was the world was flat. The writers of the Bible wrote of the earth being round. And as you read this, ask yourself, how did they know this? Isaiah 40, verse 22. Someone has that.
It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in.
Again, about 700 B.C., 400 years before Aristotle. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 27. So point being that circle. How did they know that? Well, again, this is not a science book, but when scientific principles are in here, God rings true. Ancient people believed that there were only a few stars in the heavens, according to some history books. In 50 B.C., so 50 years before Christ, there was a writer named Hipparchus, if I could pronounce it. He said there were less than 3,000 stars, so 50 years before Christ. In 150 A.D., after the death of Christ, Ptolemy said that there was not more than 3,000. So he agreed. There's about 3,000 stars out there. We didn't have telescopes. How would you know? Yet after the invention of the telescope in the Middle Ages, men discovered that the stars are innumerable. I won't get to these verses here, but we know. How many times did God talk about, I'm going to make your seed as what?
Stars.
Yeah. 3,000 are innumerable. Well, how did anybody know that? There was no telescopes. Does the Bible harmonize with history? In other words, is the Bible historically true? Are its records accurate? People question that all the time. Well, they said this, but the records don't show this, so we found this. There was a historian named Herodotus who lived in 484 B.C., 484 years before Christ. He denied that which Joseph wrote about in Genesis chapter 40 and verse 9 and verse 14. That talks about the wine bearer for Pharaoh. Okay. Now, this is 400, almost 500 years before Christ, and he was a historian, famous historian, and he claimed that that was wrong, that grapes did not grow in Egypt. That couldn't be right. Moses had it wrong. They didn't make wine. They didn't drink wine. And, of course, the unbelievers sided with him. It must be true. There's no wine there. They don't have grapes there. So how can the story be true? And they claim again Moses was wrong. They claim the Bible record was not inspired because Moses had made this blunder. It messed up. But when archaeologists explored the ancient tombs of the Egyptians, as in the pyramids, they found paintings of the Egyptians along with clusters of grapes. So over time, he was proven wrong. The Bible was historically accurate. It turns out that way. The last one, I'll try to get this quickly, is talking about Luke. Historians had condemned Luke. They said he made a mistake. Turn to Acts chapter 13 real quick. And this is going to be verses 6 through 12, but we won't do all those verses. Just do verse 6. Acts 13 and verse 6. And you're looking for what he calls Sergius Paulus here. And someone gets that. Next verse.
Who was it? The proconsul Sergius Paulus had killed him. This man called Barnabas and Saul, the son of Peter, the word of God.
That's far enough right there. Sergius Paulus, and Luke called him in the book of Acts. He wrote Acts. Called him what? His title. He was a proconsul. That's the key word we're looking for here. Okay? Historians look back and said that he should have called him not proconsul, but procreator. That's what that man was called, that office was called back then in Egypt. That was procreator, or back in Greece, even. Not proconsul. Luke had it wrong. He called him the wrong name. Luke must be lying. That's not true. Not too long ago, a coin was found in that same island with the inscription, Paulus the proconsul. They found a coin that proved that was the correct title. And so that was, although procreator may have been the usual title, historians and archaeologists found that there were some exceptions where these Roman rulers were also called proconsul. Luke had it right. God had it right. Man had it wrong. So again, inspired words to test the time on that. We'll continue that one next time. Any questions or comments?